This is Audible.
Death of a Ghost by M.C. Beaton. Read by David Monteith. Chapter 1. The Murmur of the Mourning Ghost. Sidney Thompson Dobell. Police Sergeant Hamish Macbeth was feeling trapped. He had started an affair with the head of the Strathbane Forensic Department, Christine Dalray, and had begun to feel as if he had been arrested. His police station home in the village of Loch Doo in Sutherland was no longer a refuge. He often thought wearily that he should have known that a woman who could head and command a department of boozy male chauvinists would be a control freak. Christine was attractive to look at, with long legs and curly hair. But she managed his meals, his dress, and how they performed in bed. Hamish was afraid to ditch her, in case she told the authorities that his sidekick, Police Constable Charlie Carter, was staying at a basement flat in the Tommel Castle Hotel. Charlie was too clumsy to have in the police station, but he was kind, hard-working, and amiable, which is why Hamish found himself one morning whistling for his dogs and fleeing the station to join Charlie for breakfast before Christine woke. So far, he had kept his worries about life with Christine to himself. But as he relaxed in Charlie's cosy little flat in front of the peat fire, while Charlie fried sausages, he was overcome with a desire to share his troubles. So when breakfast was over, Hamish said awkwardly, "I want rid of Christine." Charlie was a giant of a man, with childlike blue eyes and fair hair. "I saw that coming," he said. "They call her Attila the Hun over at the lab, except the H in Hun is replaced with a C, and the T..." "I get the picture," said Hamish hurriedly. "Why didn't you tell me?" "I thought you were all set for the altar," said Charlie. "What are you going to do?" "I don't know. Think of something." "Have you asked the fairies?" "For the umpteenth time, Charlie, there are no such things." Charlie sat with his head bowed. "Now I know what away with the fairies really means," thought Hamish bitterly. But Charlie suddenly looked up and grinned. "I've got it!" "Out with it." "Blair hates your guts, right?" Detective Chief Inspector Blair was the bane of Hamish's life. "What's that got to do with anything?" asked Hamish. "It's like this. I'll go down to Strathbane and gossip about how you are so mad about Christine that if she left you it would break your heart. Blair would move mountains to bring that about." "Och," said Hamish, "he'll tell her awful things about me, and she knows how much the scunner hates me. She won't listen." "He's not that daft. Worth a try." Perhaps the fairies had taken against Hamish Macbeth, because Charlie's plan worked in the worst way possible. 2 days later, he was summoned to police headquarters to face Superintendent Daviot. Daviot was in a foul mood. 8 Scottish police departments had been merged into one called Police Scotland, which seemed to mean it had become a sort of state within a state, with enough form-filling paperwork and bureaucracy to make a French bureaucrat weep with envy. He gazed over the pile of paperwork on his desk as Hamish was ushered in.
"Sit down," he said. "It's time we had a man-to-man talk."
Hamish sat down and put his cap at his feet. Daviot was a grey man, grey hair, grey eyes and grey suit. He considered Macbeth a maverick. Surely his flaming red hair couldn't be natural.
"It has come to my ears," said Daviot, "that you are cohabiting with a member of the force."
"I'm not having an affair with a policewoman," said Hamish.
"No, but the forensic department is part of Police Scotland, and there are people always on the lookout for some, well, let us call it, breaches of police etiquette."
"You are quite right, sir," said Hamish meekly. "I shall end the affair today."
Daviot suddenly smiled indulgently, remembering that any break-up would upset Hamish dreadfully.
"Now, now, Hamish, just marry the lady and I will be your best man. There! Never say we are hard-hearted."
Stunned, Hamish thanked him and walked from the room. Daviot's secretary, Helen, who had been listening at the door, smiled maliciously.
"He'll make a decent man of you yet,"
she jeered. The sudden vague look in Hamish's eyes should have warned her that the policeman was thinking of some nasty way he could get back at her. Then he pushed open the superintendent's door and went back in.
"Sir," said Hamish, "I could not help noticing you have a great deal of paperwork. Can't you delegate some of it?"
"No, a lot of these are marked for your eyes only."
"But your trusted secretary is, in fact, your eye, sir, and she has dealt with all the paperwork in the past, and so she would know better than any of us what to do."
Daviot beamed.
"I am most grateful to you, and Helen will be honoured. Don't forget to send me a wedding invitation."
Helen backed away from the door as Hamish came out. She opened her mouth to speak, but the buzzer on Daviot's desk summoned her. Hamish went off whistling, until he realised he would now have to cope with Christine. He drove slowly back to Loch Dhu. He stopped on the road and let his two dogs, Sally, a poodle, and Lugs, a mixed breed with odd blue eyes, out to play in the heather. He missed his wildcat that he had let loose in the wildcat sanctuary at Ardnamurchan. He was just whistling to get them back in the Land Rover when he saw Christine's car speeding up the road towards where he had parked. She screeched to a halt and got out.
"So, you're just another of these bastards who thinks that women belong in the kitchen," she raged. "Daviot informs me that once we are married, I have to quit my job. He told me it was all your idea, so get this. I have phoned Glasgow, and they are glad to have me back. Keep out of my way, you bastard, until I get my stuff packed and out of this peasant hole of a dump."
Hamish opened his mouth to protest, but a sudden vision of having his station back all to himself rose in his brain, and he said,
"But you'd make the grand wee wifey."
He then stood with his head bowed as she let loose a raging tirade, ending up telling him he could take his male chauvinist ideas and shove them up his scrawny arse. He decided to go to the pub in Loch Dhu to allow time for Christine to get clear. When he walked into the pub, four forestry workers hurried out, frightened that Hamish would take away their car keys. Hamish saw Archie MacLean seated at a table by the window, ordered a double tonic water, and went to join the fisherman.
"I hear she's leaving you," said Archie. "It's a right gossipy place," said Hamish sourly, "except when I'm trying to solve a crime. Then everyone's seen nothing, don't know nothing." "It's the idleness," said Archie sententiously. "See, at the moment, there are only the tourist folk."
Archie augmented his fishing with taking tourists round the loch in the summer.
"Now, right now, I'm hiding out from the wifey. Women get our bossy, Hamish, when they think you might be enjoying a bit of lazy time."
"You mean I need a murder?"
"That would have helped."
"I don't like bullies," said Hamish. "And talking of bullies, when are you going to tell that wife of yours to stop boiling your clothes? I mean, who ever heard of a woman boiling tweed? That jacket of yours would fit a bairn. You stood up to her once."
Hamish heard a voice calling from outside.
"Has anyone seen Archie?"
Archie darted across the pub and crouched down behind the bar. Mrs. MacLean came in, eyes darting to right and left. She was a short, thin woman who smelled of bleach.
"Have you seen Archie?"
she demanded, stopping by Hamish's table.
"Saw him outside," said Hamish. "Poor wee man was off to the doctor." "What's up with him?" "He's got strangulitis." "What's that?" "It's a soreness in the balls caused by constriction."
She let out a squawk of dismay and hurried off. Hamish went to the bar and leaned over.
"Get yourself to Dr. Brodie, and I'll warn him. Out the back way, and with any luck you'll get there before her."
Archie said,
"She'll have gone home for her best bonnet."
Hamish returned to his table and phoned the doctor and explained Archie's soon-to-arrive visit.
"He's got to get into comfortable clothes, or his arteries will close up with the constriction," said Hamish.
"I'll do my best," said Dr. Brodie, sounding amused.
"How did you get the news so quickly?" he called after Archie. "Herself was in Patel's buying fags, and she told the whole shop. She called you..."
"Okay, Archie, I'd rather imagine it. I think it's damn odd that she smokes, her and her tofu and salads."
"I think maybe you should get along there. Mr. Patel has a cheap line in red paint, and she bought a can."
"I don't care," said Hamish, uneasily. "I'm not having another confrontation."
"When you get back, I'd throw out all your food," said Archie. "I saw this documentary, and there are all these wee sneaky poisons."
"What I need," said Hamish, "is a nice crime."
"Ah, well, you may be having it. I've just seen Charlie walk past the window. I'd best be off before the wife gets to the surgery."
The door opened, and Charlie walked in, banged his head on a beam, tripped over a chair, and landed all of his over 6 foot length on the pub floor. He got to his feet, rubbed his blonde hair, and looked sheepishly at Hamish.
"We've got an odd report from Drim," said Charlie.
"Sit down and join us," said Hamish. "You're looming."
Charlie sat down and winced as the chair gave a sinister creaking sound.
"It's a ghost," he said.
"So who's the potty one over in Drim who thinks they've seen a ghost? Saturday night when the pubs scale, I get reports of ghosts and fairies and things that go bump in the night."
"Aye, but this is from Hanover Ebrington at the castle."
"Is that the new owner? But the place is half a ruin."
"He's a retired police superintendent from Glasgow, so we'd better jump to it," said Charlie.
"Och, michty, the man's probably a drunk. Let's go."
There are many castles in the Highlands, a lot of them mere ruins. Castle Drim had once been habitable, but it was up on a bluff overlooking Loch Drim, and the gales of Sutherland had done a lot to destroy a part of it.
"He must be a drunk," complained Hamish, as they took the one-track road to Drim. "The Highlands are crammed with folk who've sozzled their brains into romantic dreams of Bonnie Prince Charlie and all that."
"Doesn't it matter?" said Charlie gloomily. "He was a police super, right? So he'll throw his weight around. You shouldn't have brought the dogs along."
As they approached the castle, Hamish noticed scaffolding at the front. The short drive had recently been cleared of weeds, and gravel had been put down. He remembered that the 18th-century bit at the front was habitable, but the 15th-century bit to the left of the main entrance was in ruins. He wondered if his arch-enemy, Detective Chief Inspector Blair, had already arrived. He imagined the retired super would be pugnacious and rude like Blair. The door was opened by a grey-haired man with a pleasant, weather-beaten face. He held out a hand in welcome.
"I am Hanover. A stupid name. I am usually called Handy. And you are?"
"Sergeant Hamish Macbeth of Loch Doo, sir, and Constable Carter."
"Come in and we'll have some coffee and I'll tell you all about it."
They found themselves in a small square hall. Hamish remembered it as being vast.
"Yes, I divided the hall up," said Handy, answering the unspoken question. "Will you use my study?"
He opened a door and led them into a comfortable room. A coal fire was blazing. Two high-backed leather armchairs were on either side of the fire, with a sofa and coffee table placed in front of the hearth. A flat-screen television was mounted on the wall. There were two landscapes of Highland scenes. A tall bookcase filled up one wall, the bottom shelves full of leather-bound books, and the upper shelves crammed with brightly covered paperbacks. A worn Persian carpet covered the floor. An old console table held an array of bottles. Handy sat in one of the armchairs, and Hamish sat opposite him. Charlie lowered himself carefully onto the sofa, a smile on his face as he realized he had managed to enter the room without breaking anything. The door opened, and a woman came in carrying a tray laden with coffee and biscuits.
"Help yourselves," she said curtly, and shuffled out on a pair of old carpet slippers.
"That's my sister, Frida," said Handy. "Sour-faced old Bism. Who's going to be mother?"
"I'll pour," said Hamish.
"Black for me," said Handy.
Handy had a pleasant Glasgow accent. Because of Blair's harsh, guttural tones, Hamish had forgotten there was such a thing.
"I suppose you think I've been drinking whisky," he said, "but it's really scary. It comes from the old ruined end of the place. I'll take you up there when you've had your coffee. Always at night. It starts up just after midnight, moaning and groaning. Of course, I've gone to investigate, but there's nothing there, and the sound comes from all around. I can't get any of the folk up from the village. They say they're scared to death."
"And it's always at night?" asked Hamish.
"Yes."
"Charlie and I will bring our sleeping bags along this evening, and we'll see if we can find out anything."
"Maybe," said Charlie. "Two people would frighten away the ghostie."
Hamish realized his highly superstitious sidekick was beginning to believe in the existence of ghosts. Well, it was time he learned there just weren't any such things.
"As I said, we'll both be here tonight."
"Right," said Handy. "I'll show you where it is."
On the other side of the hall was a massive oak door. He unlocked it to reveal a large round room, probably the remains of a tower. A lot of Scottish castles are simply tall buildings of about 6 stories, sometimes with a tower at one corner and crow-step gables. Only the tower bit remained, or what was left of it. The roof was open to the sky in places, and the wind howled through old arrow slits. Charlie clutched Hamish.
"Get off," said Hamish. "It's only the wind."
"Aye, it was more than that, Hamish," said Handy. "Like screams from hell."
Hamish felt a little jolt of pleasure at being on first-name terms with a chief superintendent, even though the man was retired.
"We won't disturb you any more," said Hamish. "We'll be back at midnight."
"Come before then and have a dram and something to eat, lads. Say about 8?
"Thank you," said Hamish.
He grinned.
"I think our Charlie will need a bit of Dutch courage."
"What is it, Mr. Blair?"
Chief Superintendent Daviot was demanding, just as Hamish and Charlie were climbing into the Land Rover.
"You know, sir," said Blair,
his pudgy hands folded and an oily expression on his groggy face,
"that we like to treat folk equal, rich and poor alike. I remember a speech of yours and..."
"Get to the point," snapped Daviot.
"It's just that Macbeth has had a report from some new owner of Castle Drim that it's haunted. I heard a report that he and Carter had gone to investigate. There was this shoplifting hour at nothing, but they weren't available."
"This is disgraceful. Tell Macbeth to get over to nothing. I will tell this new owner personally that we cannot be wasting police time. What is his name?"
Blair snickered, and then said,
"Hanover Ebrington."
"Bound to be some jumped-up southerner," said Daviot, "hoping to give himself a bit of class by buying a ruin. Ask Helen on your road out to get his phone number."
Blair could not rouse Hamish, and was made furious when a call came in that the shoplifting culprit had been discovered, and it was only some poor old biddy with dementia. Meanwhile, Daviot, having secured the number, dialed it, looking forward to giving this upstart a putting down.
"This is Chief Superintendent Daviot of the Strathbane Police."
"Do you still call it that?" asked Handy. "I thought it was all Police Scotland now."
"Never mind that," snapped Daviot. "I would have you know, Mr. Ebrington, that my staff have more to do with their time than play at Ghostbusters."
"Don't patronise me," said Handy, in a quiet voice, somehow more menacing than if he had shouted. "I've had more years of experience and commendations than you've had hot dinners. Someone is deliberately frightening the people of the village, and I want to find out who it is."
"You were in the force yourself?" asked Daviot.
"Chief Super. Retired as soon as Police Stupid Scotland came along."
"Mr. Ebrington, I assure you, sir, the situation was badly described to me. Is Macbeth looking into it?"
"He is. Courteous chap. You lot could learn from him."
The phone was slammed down. Daviot pressed the button on his desk.
"Helen," he said, "I am in need of a Tunnock's tea cake, and send Blair to me."
"Let's go down to the village," said Hamish. "I remember when there was a murder here, and then the minister's wife made a film. A lot of tourists came. Just want to make sure they're not trying to drum up trade."
It was a windy spring day, with great clouds sending shadows racing across the loch and surrounding mountains. The village lay at the end of a long sea loch on a flat piece of land. The loch was black, as it was a thin sort of corridor between the walls of the mountains on either side. Black mountains, nearly devoid of any softening greenery at all, where little grew among the rock and scree but stunted bushes. The village of Drim consisted of a huddle of houses, with the general store at one end and the church at the other. A round church, because everyone knew that evil spirits could only live in corners.
"There's a new minister here," said Hamish. "Let's call on him first."
"Didn't think the Kirk could afford to put a minister in this wee place," said Charlie.
"It's a good manse, and the poor soul is expected to preach at four other villages on the Sabbath."
"Haven't you called on him afore this?" asked Charlie curiously. "You aye call on newcomers."
"Not all," said Hamish. "There've been three of them afore this one. I'm surprised he lasted the winter."
"What's his name?"
"Peter Haggis. I'll bet he gets teased about his name."
"You forget, Charlie, ministers are treated with respect. He's not married."
Hamish rang the brass bell, set into the sandstone wall of the manse, beside the door. The door was opened by a thin, angry-looking woman. Hamish guessed her to be in her 40s. She had dusty black hair, pulled up into a knot on the top of her head. Her sallow face had deep lines on either side of her full-lipped mouth. Her eyes were large and quite beautiful, brown with flecks of gold, like a peat stream with the sunlight glinting on it. Hamish introduced them, explained the reason for his call, and asked to see the minister.
"I don't think that would be a good idea," she said.
"Why is that? And who are you?" demanded Hamish.
"I'm his sister, Sheila."
"Sheila!"
The minister appeared behind his sister.
"Why must you always leave people standing on the step? Come in, gentlemen. How can I assist you?"
He was a small man with thick grey hair, a sensuous mouth, and small blue eyes. Hamish and Charlie, with their caps tucked under their arms, followed him into what was obviously his study. It was lined with ancient dusty tomes. Hamish suddenly remembered being in this room before, and the books looked the same, the historical leavings of previous ministers, no doubt stretching back to John Knox. Were they printing books in the time of Mary, Queen of Scots? The Reverend Peter Haggis stared impatiently at the tall policeman with the flaming red hair, who was standing with his mouth a little open, his hazel eyes vague.
"Why are you here?" demanded Peter sharply.
"It is about the haunting at Drim Castle," said Charlie.
"Oh, forget that," said Peter briskly. "Nothing but the wind. Take my advice and leave well alone. The locals are too superstitious as it is. Oh, what now, Sheila?"
His sister was just backing into the room, holding a tray laden with coffee cups, a coffee pot, and biscuits.
"No, they're leaving," he shouted. "Take that muck away."
Hamish and Charlie followed Sheila out into the small, dark hall.
"Your brother is very frightened," said Hamish.
She swung the front door open.
"Sod off," she yelled, "and don't come back."
Hamish's mobile phone rang.
"It's Daviot," he muttered.
"Yes, sir?" "You are to give all your time to finding out where these ghostly noises are coming from. Do I make myself clear?"
"I haven't stopped working on it," said Hamish, puzzled.
"Good, good. Keep at it."
"Has everyone gone daft?" said Hamish, after he told Charlie about Daviot's call.
"I would think that our friend Blair found out and told Daviot you were wasting police time. Daviot then finds out about Handy having been a chief superintendent and starts to grovel. And talking about daft, some of the cottages have crossed round branches on the door. Could be play-acting. Let's try the shop and see what Jock Kennedy has to say about all this. If you get the dogs out, I'll get us a couple of mutton pies and beer. Jock does the best mutton pies in Scotland, and my pampered pets can have tinned dog meat and like it."
Jock Kennedy was a giant of a man. Hamish was equally tall, but thin and lanky, whereas Jock was broad-shouldered with a great bull-like head. As he heated the pies and pulled out cans of beer and cans of dog food, Jock said in reply to Hamish's questions,
"We don't talk about them."
"Stop talking havers. Who the hell is them?"
Jock leaned on the counter.
"The evil spirits."
"A man like you," jeered Hamish, "frightened of a lot of noises."
Jock leaned right over the counter and whispered,
"You should see what they did to the kirk. Minister himself was preaching against superstition. They come doon for the castle in the night and painted the altar table red wi' blood."
Chapter 2. And Things That Go Bump in the Night. Good Lord, Deliver Us. Anonymous.
"Why didn't he say so?" asked Charlie. "I mean, he wants folk to think it's a lot of bollocks. That's straightforward, ordinary vandalism."
Jock looked nervously around.
"What makes you think that?"
It was as if Jock's superstitious fears were making Charlie lose his own.
"See here," said Charlie, "Hamish and me are going to sleep in the tower tonight, and we'll find out exactly who is playing silly buggers."
"If you want to be safe, I'd go to the church this evening. Haggis preaches a good sermon."
"Turned religious, Jock?" asked Hamish.
"The noises coming from that tower are enough to make a Protestant cross himself," said Jock.
Outside the shop, Hamish and Charlie sat on a bench and ate their pies and drank beer, while Hamish's dogs, Lugs and Sally, reluctantly sniffed the dog food and ate only some of it.
"Ach, the poor wee souls," said Charlie. "I'll get them a couple of pies."
Left on his own, Hamish sent his Highland radar out, feeling for oddities in the atmosphere. The wind had suddenly died, and there was a dampness in the air. Hamish hoped it wouldn't rain, as there was no roof to the tower. He sensed a bad atmosphere, a waiting atmosphere. "The villagers are waiting for something bad to happen," he thought. "I'll maybe go to church this evening. Frightened people always end up in church." Everything was still and calm. Suddenly the wind came back. Ripples of waves ran down the long sea loch and sent clumps of sea pinks by the water's edge, bobbing and nodding. Hamish was seated in church that evening with Charlie, not listening at first to the reading, because he was hoping that, if there was a God, he would take care of his cat, Sonsy, that he had returned to the wild.
"Hot stuff,"
he realised Charlie was whispering. Peter Haggis was up in the pulpit, holding on to the wings of the brass eagle and reading from the King James Bible's version of the Song of Solomon. His voice, filled with passion, rose up to the circular stained glass window.
"Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine."
His eyes were burning, and he seemed to know the words by heart.
"A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night twixt my breasts."
"He's directing all this at somebody," thought Hamish. With his height, and from his pew at the back of the church, he saw that the target of the minister's fervour was probably the owner of the silky fair hair in the third pew from the front. "Just suppose," Hamish mused, "that if Haggis and that blonde are having an affair, maybe they meet at the tower and have a tape of screams and yells to scare people away. No, that's daft. They wouldn't hear anyone coming. I wonder what Christine wanted the red paint for." Back to the blonde. "Now, if she's married to the man next to her, then trouble could be brewing. Aha! Sister Sheila doesn't like all this Song of Solomon passionate reading. When she's not chewing her fingernails, she's looking at the blonde with sheer hatred. Why is she stuck up here in this remotest part of the British Isles with her brother? What's the attraction?" The reading was over, and the congregation rose to sing, "O God, from whom all blessings flow." The sermon was about loving thy neighbour as thyself, but Hamish thought cynically that the minister's thoughts were on carnal love rather than spiritual. He began to get angry. The church was full. All these villagers had come for a bit of spiritual comfort, but they may as well have attended a black mass. He was so angry that he delayed leaving the church until every member of the congregation had shaken the minister's hand at the church door and left.
"Good evening, officer. I trust you enjoyed our little service."
"No," said Hamish. "There was damn all spiritual comfort. If you want to get into her knickers, keep it outside the church."
"I don't know what you're talking about, but you are coarse and rude, and I will report you."
"Oh, please do," said Hamish.
He crammed his cap on his red hair and walked off.
"Now you shouldn't have said that," said Charlie. "Not like you to be vulgar."
"I got angry," said Hamish ruefully. "This damn place always upsets me."
"I notice you've been a wee bitty on edge lately," said Charlie. "Maybe you're going through what Archie claims is the men's pause."
"Still too young. You have to be over 40 and get a craving for a leather jacket and a Harley."
"There's something bad in the air."
"Well, Handy has invited us for supper. Wish we had someone like him in charge."
"Why do you think he really wanted to retire up here?" asked Charlie.
"God knows.
Mind you, it's had a couple of previous owners who've already done a lot of restoration on the 18th century bit. Besides, it was probably as cheap as chips."
Hamish approached the police station cautiously. "Here I am," he thought, "an officer of the law, wearing a utility belt with taser, spray and restraints, and I'm scared of one woman." He would not admit guilt was causing the fear. His dogs ran ahead and threw the large flap on the door. He stood outside the door. She wouldn't, would she? Would she have played that trick of balancing a pot of paint so that when he opened the door it would fall on him? But the door was closed. Where could she balance it? He went in. The kitchen was clean and sparkling. The dogs were lapping at their water bowls. Hamish felt the tension leave his shoulders. He went into his living room and lit the fire. "Oh, peace that passeth understanding," said Hamish, stretching out his long legs to the fire. Sally, the poodle, jumped up on the sofa on one side of him, and Lugs climbed up on the other.
"Damn," muttered Hamish, "I forgot to lock up the hens."
He went out to the henhouse and shooed the birds in. He was about to shut the door when he saw a dim light shining at the back of the shed. He walked forward and bent down. The glow was coming from a small nightlight in the shape of a blue pig. He picked it up and stood up. There was a cord attached to it. He gave it an impatient tug, and then suddenly jumped aside as a pot of red paint tilted its contents down into the shed.
"Christine!"
He shouted her name like an oath. His boots were spattered, but at least his uniform jersey and trousers had been spared. Fortunately, it turned out to be emulsion paint. If it had been gloss, he would have had to spend a long time getting rid of it in case the fumes made the birds ill. He was sure that Handy would not expect Charlie and himself to be in uniform, so, back in the station, he changed into an old sweater and jeans, found a warm coat and hat, and rolled up his sleeping bag. Hamish decided not to take his pets with him. He knew that, once home for the night, they usually slept until morning. He reluctantly put his utility belt on again. It got heavier and heavier every year, he thought sourly, as more gadgets were added to it. He drove to the Tommel Castle Hotel, where Charlie was waiting impatiently in the courtyard.
"George wanted to come with us," said Charlie. "Let's get out of here."
George was Colonel Halberton Smythe, owner of the hotel. Although devoted to Charlie, he showed signs of wanting to be a sort of Poirot. He was also in competition with Hamish Macbeth, the man who had been engaged to his beautiful daughter Priscilla, and then had broken off the engagement. He wanted to show that Hamish was nothing more than a Highland idiot with an undeserved reputation. Charlie loaded a huge hamper in the back and then joined Hamish.
"What have you brought?" asked Hamish. "Handy's going to feed us." "Some things I need," said Charlie, folding his lips in a firm line.
Hamish told Charlie about the red paint.
"Women can get awfully petty," said Charlie. "Mind you, she didn't like those birds. Couldn't understand why you didn't put one in the oven. Nor could she understand why you didn't send your old sheep to the shambles."
"I'll get around to it," said Hamish sulkily.
When they arrived at Drim, the sun was just setting behind the tall, jagged mountains that guarded the loch. Later on in the summer, it would be light all night long. The evening air smelled of wild thyme, bell heather, salt and tar. But Hamish suddenly stiffened on Handy's doorstep, like a hound scenting game.
"What's up?" asked Charlie.
Hamish shook himself.
"Just a feeling. There's violence in the air. Maybe a storm coming."
He rang the bell, and Frida, Handy's sister, answered the door. Rather than the sulky, sullen dame of their previous visit, she smiled a welcome.
"He's in the drawing room," she said.
Her Glasgow accent was stronger than her brother's. She had thick brown hair, a small face and small twinkling eyes. She walked in front of them, clumsily, on a pair of very high heels.
"I'm trying them out again," she said, holding open the door of the drawing room. "Heels, that is. If you stop wearing them, it's difficult to get used to them again. You walk like a man trying to look like a woman."
Handy rose to meet them. He was wearing an expensive-looking tweed jacket, a white shirt, and a silk tie.
"I'm afraid we're no suitably dressed," said Hamish.
"You're dressed for ghost hunting, and that's all that matters," said Handy. "Drink? Got a 12-year-old malt."
They both accepted crystal tumblers of whisky. Hamish looked around the drawing room and began to feel uneasy. He knew precious little about antiques, but he recognised good old furniture when he saw it. Various pieces seemed to glow in the soft lamplight. The sofa he and Charlie were sitting on had deep feather cushions and was made of mahogany and basketwork.
"Sanitary towels, Hamish," said Handy, looking amused.
For one mad moment, Hamish thought this was a new sort of oath.
"My dad was Lady Jane Sanitary Towels. Left a fortune to my brother John, because Dad was furious at me going into the police force. Well, poor John died at his desk in the factory, and all the money came to me. I'd got sick of the police force, the paperwork, the targets, seeing good men leaving because they couldn't stand it anymore, so I got out. But I like working. I gave a lot of money to charity and bought this place with the idea of doing it over and selling it at a profit. Frida's just getting over a nasty divorce."
"Charlie and I went to the kirk this evening," said Hamish. "The minister was reading from the Song of Solomon, with his heart in every word."
"So, who is the blonde?
I only saw the back of her head."
"That'd be Olivia Sinclair, ex-model, married to Selwyn Sinclair, owner of Sinclair Electronics."
"But I mind the factory is over outside Tane," said Hamish.
"Aye, but he lives in the old Carrington place, that big place on the Laird Road, stuck in the middle of nowhere. Folk do say he bought it to keep his flirty wife out of playing games. I don't think she realised he was religious until she married him. Married last year. I'd give it a few months if he doesn't kill her first. Mind you, maybe he just drags her to the kirk out of spite."
Hamish shifted uneasily.
"Sometimes a woman can get a man so besotted that he'll do it for them. Murder, I mean.
Trouble is that Sister Sheila fancies Selwyn, and that one is a red-hot bundle of passion with nowhere to go."
"Oh, well," said Hamish. "A lot of folk come to the Highlands, but one winter usually sees them off."
"I know what you mean," said Frida. "My poor brother. I can't take any more of this isolation. I'm off back to Glasgow next week. It's a good thing I have a generous brother, because dear Daddy left me sod all."
Peter Haggis was smouldering like the peat fire on his living room hearth.
"He beats her. I know it," he said savagely. "When she shook hands with me in the porch, her sleeve slid back, and there was a great bruise on her arm."
"She probably painted it on. She's working you up, you fool," raged his sister. "Her husband is a fine man, and she's trying to break him."
But Peter barely heard her. He clasped his hands in prayer. The firelight turned his eyes to gleaming red. Sheila, his sister, stared at him with a feeling of despair. She put on her coat and went outside. A sudden gust of wind whistled down the loch, sending ripples of dark, choppy waves glittering with the reflections of the first stars racing towards the village. There was a drought in the Highlands. It hadn't rained for months, but bad weather was forecast. Sheila looked up at the sky. Above the craggy tops of the mountains, long fingers of black were beginning to stream in from the west. She felt worried and miserable. She had considered it her Christian duty to devote her life to her brother, but that was when he had a pleasant parish in Perth. Suddenly, he had decided to move to Drim, of all places. She reflected that it had all started at the New Year's Eve ball in Perth 2 years ago. Olivia had been there, dazzling all the men. It was there her engagement was announced. It was also there that Sheila had seen her brother at one point in the evening, holding Olivia closely in a waltz, and afterwards looking completely dazed. Selwyn was a good man. But she had forgotten about it, until he suddenly announced he was moving to Drim. That was until Olivia began to appear in the village. "Miss Haggis?" said a voice behind her, making her jump. Sheila swung round. The man held the torch he was carrying up to his face.
"Mr. Sinclair!"
exclaimed Sheila. After a good dinner, Hamish and Charlie settled into their sleeping bags on the floor of the tower. A loud whistling and moaning started up.
"What's that?"
yelled Charlie.
"It's the wind getting up," said Hamish. "It's those arrow slits makes that moaning sound."
"There's a creepy rustling sound.
Charlie, we're lying on piles and piles of dry leaves. The draught is moving them around."
"I don't like the situation in Drim."
"The ghosts?" "No, the minister and his sister. Now, Sheila Haggis is one walking time bomb."
"Why?"
"Plain wee biddy.
She's got beautiful eyes and a passionate mouth."
"Hamish, I thought you'd be our the ladies for the moment. I don't fancy her, but someone might. Go to sleep."
"I canna sleep.
Do you think it might be the ghost of old Mungo Mackay?"
"No."
Mungo Mackay had been a Jacobite sympathiser. After Culloden, the castle had been set on fire, and Mungo and his wife and son had perished in the flames. They had gone to the top of the tower for safety. As the fire had not touched the attached living quarters, an English officer had moved in. He was found with his throat cut before his family could join him. Since then, it had had various owners. Hamish woke up in the morning. A hazy sun was shining down from a milky sky. He sat up and nudged Charlie awake.
"There you are, Charlie," said Hamish. "No ghosts, only the wind up in those remaining arrow slits."
"I don't think Handy would have dragged us up here if it was only the wind," said Charlie. "We didn't search for clues. I mean, folk in the village would know we were here."
Hamish was thinking of bacon baps and hot coffee from the shop in Drim, and said impatiently,
"What clues?"
Charlie started to walk up and down, scraping the leaves aside with his size 12 boots. He had almost reached one of the walls when he gave a great cry and disappeared through the floor. Hamish rushed over. He stared down into the darkness.
"Charlie! Answer me. Are you all right?"
"Aye. I fell on sacks. Can you shine a torch down here? I haven't put my belt on."
Hamish retrieved his own torch and shone it down into the hole. A broken flight of steps was revealed.
"I'm coming down," he said.
Hamish gingerly felt his way down the steps. When he reached the bottom, he swung his powerful torch round the place.
"We've got company, Charlie," said Hamish.
"What?"
"There's a wee man over there, and he's very, very dead."
Chapter 3 "Them that asks no questions isn't told a lie. Watch the wall, my darling, while the gentlemen go by." Rudyard Kipling. Hamish took out his phone.
"No signal here, Charlie. I'll use the radio in the car. Are you sure you didn't knock your head or anything?"
"I'm just bruised.
Oh, sir, dinna leave me here with a dead man. I don't be daft. He's dead. He's not a ghost. I'll be back in a minute.
But Hamish was much longer. He got a flask of coffee and two bacon baps from the shop, and then made a call to police headquarters, and then a call to Handy, telling him what had happened. He had forgotten how superstitious Charlie could be, but never did he expect to find him shaking with terror and half-fainting.
"Pull yourself together, ye great ox! Look! Coffee and baps!"
"He spoke to me," said Charlie, through white lips.
"What? The dead man?"
"No, the Mackay,"
a voice shouted down the hall.
"Can I come down?" "I'm afraid not, Handy," Hamish called back. "It's a crime scene." "Do you know who it is?" "No, although there's something familiar about the face. Not much decomposition. Middle-aged. Expensive sports jacket and cords. No sign of injury. But I daren't examine him. I'll photograph him with my phone. The pathologist and the fool circus from Strathbane will be here soon."
Hamish turned his attention back to Charlie.
"Dead men don't speak. You probably heard Handy."
"Hamish, I heard him."
"So what did he say?"
"He said, 'You're doomed, laddie.'"
"Did you see his lips move?"
No, but
Havers, you daft lummox. It's the fear talking to you. That is one very dead corpse. Let's see if we can find another way out of here. Come on, stand up. Now, shine your torch around and I'll shine mine."
Then Hamish exclaimed,
"There, on the left, that pile of boxes looks new. Keep the torch on them until I shift them."
"If Blair comes along, he'll have you for messing up a crime scene," said Charlie.
"If you really did hear a voice, then there's another way in here," panted Hamish, sending boxes crashing to the floor. "They're full of stones." "Yes, there's a door, and it's new, and there's a great padlock. I'll just pick it. Hold that torch steady."
Hamish worked away at the padlock with a skeleton key, selected from a bunch he always carried with him. At last it clicked open. The door turned out to lead to a low, rocky passage, black as pitch.
"Bring the sandwiches and flask, Charlie," said Hamish.
They walked along it, crouched down, shining their torches, until they came to another door. Again Hamish had to fiddle with the padlock. That door opened on piles of gorse bushes piled up at the entrance. They kicked them aside and found themselves looking down at the remains of a landing stage on the loch.
"Smugglers again, I bet," said Hamish bitterly. "Had them here before. One of them must have gone along that tunnel and pretended to be a ghost to frighten you, Charlie."
"If I get my hands on the bastard, I'll kick his teeth in," said Charlie bitterly. "Had me as feared as a bairn. There's Handy waving to us. Wait till he hears what we've found."
"Not yet," said Hamish. "What do we really know about him? He could be corrupt. Let's sit down and eat our breakfast."
They sat on the edge of the jetty, their great regulation boots mirrored in the black water below. When they had finished eating, Hamish said,
"We'd better find out who the missing man was.
There's something about him. You know, I think I saw the chiel on the telly," said Charlie. "Let's be having a look at that photo you took."
Hamish showed him the photograph. Charlie shook his big head.
"Funny that," he said. "Now I think I must have imagined it. If it's smugglers, we'll have to put an end to their smuggling."
"Maybe not," said Hamish. "They'll wait a few months and start up again. Let's go and join Handy."
Hamish showed Handy a picture of the dead man. "There's something familiar about him," said Handy, "but folk look different when they're dead." A police helicopter sailed into view and landed on the flat bit of shore by the loch. First to descend was Superintendent Daviot, but, to Hamish's relief, he was followed only by an elderly man he judged to be the pathologist, the official photographer, and his friend, Detective Inspector Jimmy Anderson. Daviot rushed forward to greet Handy.
"Maybe he's going to say Mr. Ebrington, I presume," muttered Hamish.
and Charlie let out an unmanly giggle. "I wonder if you recognise me," said Handy. "We haven't met before, have we?"
"I think I saw you at one of the Edinburgh functions," said David, who had, in fact, looked up Handy's photograph on the internet.
"It is beginning to rain," came the testy voice of the pathologist, "or am I expected to stand here freezing my assets off?"
David swung round and glared at Hamish.
"Why are you still standing there, Macbeth? Take Sir James Creedy to the body."
"Just waiting for orders, sir," said Hamish amiably. "I'll lead the way, Sir James. Not often we get the honour of your presence. I've read about your work."
Jimmy followed behind, feeling crossly that he should have been the one ordered to take care of the pathologist. Sir James was tall and thin, with a high-bridged nose, and a way of walking forward, as if he were about to fall over. Hamish thought he looked like a heron.
"We've just discovered a passage," said Hamish, "which would be safer for you, as the steps inside are a bit dangerous. But I'm hoping the forensic boys might find something there that can lead us to the murderer."
They reached the hole in the floor. Hamish unhitched his torch and shone it down the broken steps.
"I'll need more light," complained the pathologist. "I'll wait for the forensic team. In the meantime, give me a torch so that I can look at the body from here."
Sir James shone the torch down, and then turned the beam to right and left.
"I don't see a body," he complained. "If you will allow me, sir," said Hamish, taking back his torch.
He gingerly made his way down the stairs, and shone the beam onto where he had seen the body lying. There was no body. He desperately searched to left and right.
"What are you doing?" shouted Jimmy from above. "You're contaminating a crime scene with your great boots."
"The body's gone," wailed Hamish. "Someone's stolen the body."
Not only was there the misery of losing a dead body, but it turned out to be the one day the drought broke at last. Great, gusty gales carrying slashing rain poured down between the mountains from the Atlantic. Hamish fretted. He could only be glad that he had taken that photograph. He had sent it on to police headquarters in Strathbane. After an hour, the report came back. Hamish's dead man was a Professor John Gordon, who was fixated on the idea of there being no God. He travelled the country, ranting and raving as he gave lectures to that effect. He had been due to speak at an outdoor meeting in Golspie a week before, but had never turned up. Before that, he had preached on the non-existence of God at a meeting in Strathbane. His sermons were popular with the young and loathed by the old. There had been smugglers in Drim before, and Hamish was sure they were back again. Maybe the professor had been examining the ruin and had stumbled upon them, and so they had killed him. But if that was the case, where was his car? Last seen, he was driving a Volvo. Daviot was worried. He was now faced with the delicate task of interviewing a retired chief superintendent. Handy invited him into the hall, but kept him standing, and curtly declared he had never seen the professor before, alive or dead. Daviot had brought Hamish, Charlie, and Jimmy as backup. He went on questioning Handy, asking about his movements during the past week. He stiffened as Hamish's gentle voice said, "I was thinking that Mr. Ebrington here would hardly have encouraged two police officers to spend the night in the tower if he had known anything about a dead body."
"Should I even dare to suggest such a thing?" raged Daviot. "Speak only when you're spoken to, Macbeth." "In that case," said Handy coldly, "why are you asking me what I've been doing for the last week, and if I ever had any dealings with the dead man?" "Simply routine," snapped Daviot. "Take over, Anderson. I'm taking the helicopter and Sir James back with me. I'm sure Macbeth will run you back to Strathbane at some point. You and Carter are to spend the day questioning the villagers."
He stalked out.
"Anyone like a dram?" asked Handy.
"Kind of you," said Jimmy. "I'll just get rid of these two." "These two are friends of mine, and when I last looked, a squad of policemen had been drafted in to question the villagers."
He led the way into the study, and bent down and lit the fire, which had already been set with coals and kindling. He served whiskies all round, and then asked, "What happened to the ferocious Detective Chief Inspector Blair?"
"Told not to come. Mr. Daviot was frightened he might offend you," said Jimmy.
"Pity," said Handy. "I was looking forward to putting that one firmly in his place."
"From your experience, sir," Hamish was beginning.
"Handy, please. From your experience before today, did you sense anything wrong about the village?"
"I didn't suspect any villainy. I felt sure someone was playing tricks, playing at ghosts, but that distracted me. Anyway, it's now a case of find the smugglers and you'll find your murderers."
"I wonder what they were smuggling," said Hamish.
"Drugs, possibly.
If it had been cigarettes or booze, they might just have stunned him."
"But we don't know how he died, do we?" asked Charlie.
"No, not even that," said Hamish. "I was frightened to even turn the body over in case I got accused of contaminating the crime scene."
Handy looked with some amusement at Jimmy, who was sipping a rare old malt, his eyes half closed with pleasure.
"What about you, Mr. Anderson?"
Jimmy hauled himself back from a dream country of bright fires and old malt whiskies by the barrel.
"Though, maybe move up the coast. Isn't Loch Drim a tricky place to get into, Hamish?"
"Aye, it'll take experienced sailors."
Hamish sat up. "That means folk with local knowledge."
"Or someone prepared to sell that knowledge and act as a pilot," suggested Charlie.
"And someone local would know about the tower and about that secret passage," said Hamish.
He rose reluctantly to his feet.
"Charlie and I had better scramble along to the head of the loch and see if there are any traces of them."
As Hamish knew from previous experience, there was no path to the head of the loch. He and Charlie stumbled through the rain-slippery scree of the flanks of a mountain, finding relief in the occasional animal track. The wind was so strong and the rain so heavy, it was as if some giant were throwing buckets of water into their faces. Hamish stopped suddenly.
"This is ridiculous," he shouted. "We'll not be able to see a thing, what with the great waves and the rain. We'll come back when it's calmed down."
On returning to the castle to report to Jimmy that he would be better doing some research on the backgrounds of various people on the computer, he learned that Handy's sister, Frida, had been going to Strathbane to do some shopping, and Jimmy had begged a lift. Hamish dropped Charlie off at the Tummel Castle Hotel. Once inside his station, he fed his dogs, stripped off, and had a warm bath. Dressed in casual clothes, he lit the fire in the living room and, cradling a mug of coffee, and with his dogs settled on the sofa on either side of him, turned his mind to the case of the disappearing professor. But it had been a long and exhausting day, and his eyes began to close, thinking how peaceful it was without Christine bossing him around. Hamish was abruptly woken half an hour later by a banging on the front door. It couldn't be one of the locals, he thought. They knew to use the kitchen door, as the front door had been stuck fast with damp for ages.
He shouted, "Kitchen door round the side of the station!"
And then rose reluctantly to see who had come to disturb his peace. As he opened the door, he was dreaming of a law that would let one charge people who came crashing into one's life with disturbance of the peace. Sheila Haggis stood on the doorstep, glaring up at the tall policeman with the flaming red hair and the dreamy smile on his face.
"Let me in," she snapped. "I'm Drookit."
"Still raining, I see," said Hamish. "Give me your wet coat and come through to the living room."
When she was seated in an armchair by the fire, she stared at him and said,
"The gossip in the village is that it is you who solves all the cases and lets Strathbane take the credit."
Hamish said nothing, merely smiled vaguely and said,
"How can I be of help?"
"There is a woman called Olivia Sinclair. She chases men, even though her poor husband Selwyn does not seem to notice."
"I can hardly tell Mrs. Sinclair to stop flirting," said Hamish.
"You can ask her what she was doing having lunch with Professor John Gordon 2 weeks ago in Inverness."
"You saw them?"
"I didn't recognise him until I saw his photograph on the television news this evening. That was the man I saw with her. He was holding her hand."
"I will call on her tomorrow and ask her about it," said Hamish.
"Why not tonight?"
"It's far too late," said Hamish.
Before he went to sleep, he wondered if he should tell Jimmy about this latest bit of information.
but Sheila could have made it up out of spite. Better to take Charlie and see what the lady had to say for herself. The rain had stopped the following morning, as Hamish and Charlie drove out to interview Olivia Sinclair. And yet, thought Hamish, there was more to come, because the mountains were clearly etched and had that pressing closer and nearer look. But for the moment, watery yellow sunlight shone down on the landscape, turning the one-track road to gold. On a flat plain, hedged in by tall pillared mountains, lay the Sinclairs' home. What had possessed a prosperous businessman to live in such an isolated spot, wondered Hamish. A tussocky lane led up to a square stone building, some blocked-in windows showing it dated from the days of the window tax. Hamish guessed it had originally been some lord's shooting box. There was no garden at the front. A field of heather led almost to the front door, where a solitary round tree stood guard against evil spirits. Smoke was rising from one of the tall chimneys. A Range Rover, the latest model, was parked at the side of the house. He and Charlie got out of the police Land Rover. Charlie yawned and stretched. "The air is great," he said. The landscape was very still. A curlew's plaintive call sounded from the heather. Hamish rang the brass bell beside the heavy oak door. There was a long silence. He had not heard anyone approach, but he noticed there was a spy hole in the door and had a feeling of being observed. "Police!" he called sharply, and the door swung open. Hamish had only caught a brief glimpse of Olivia Sinclair in the dimness of the church, and was prepared to find himself facing a dazzling beauty in the clear light of day. But Olivia was tall and very thin, almost to the point of anorexia. Her blonde hair, although skilfully tinted, was not natural. She was dressed in a man's checked shirt, tied at the waist over a pair of tight-fitting jeans. Olivia had a high-cheekboned face and wide blue eyes, the blue framed by a circle of black. Slav eyes, thought Hamish. Her mouth was large, and she had collagen-enhanced lips. "We have a few questions to ask you concerning Professor John Gordon," said Hamish. "I am Police Sergeant Hamish Macbeth from Loch Doo, and this is Constable Charles Carter."
"Come in," she said. "I have just made some fresh coffee. We'll have it in the sitting room."
The room into which she led them had that soulless feel left by a professional interior decorator. Everything was in shades of brown and gold. There was no clutter of books or magazines. They waited as she poured mugs of coffee. Then she asked,
"Why are you here?"
"We have received a report that you were seen in an Inverness restaurant holding hands with Professor John Gordon."
"Oh, is that who he was? He simply invaded my table, seized my hand and said, 'You are the most beautiful lady I have ever seen.' I told him to get lost and he did. Real weirdo in my opinion." "Who told you this?" "Oh, I know. The Haggis female. That repressed creature lusts after my husband."
"And does the minister lust after you?"
"I don't know. A lot of men do, particularly in this godforsaken place. But usually they go off and take their frustrations out on the nearest sheep."
To Hamish's surprise, Charlie laughed. He looked at him. To his even greater surprise, Charlie was gazing at Olivia with adoration in his eyes.
"So you have never seen the professor before?" pursued Hamish.
"Nope, can't help. You lost the body, didn't you? What a hoot."
"So what restaurant did you meet the professor in?"
"Maggie's Heel and Hame, one of those down-market macaroni and cheese places on Ness Bank."
"And when exactly were you there?"
"Wait a minute. Selwyn insists on receipts for everything."
She disappeared and came back after a few minutes, holding out a receipt. Hamish took it.
"And I need a receipt for that," said Olivia.
Hamish wrote one out and gave it to her. He sensed that inside she was laughing at him. So when he and Charlie were back in the Land Rover, Hamish said, "We'll just run down to Inverness and check this out."
"But if the Inverness police catch us poaching on their territory, they'll report us," said Charlie.
"We'll nip home first and change into ordinary clothes and take one of the hotel cars," said Hamish.
"I don't see why we're bothering," said Charlie, huffily. "We should be out at Loch Drim looking for the body. That bonny lassie had nothing to do with it."
"Are you talking about Olivia Sinclair? She's a tarted-up bag of bones."
"With all due respect, watch your mouth, sir."
"We're not going to quarrel," retorted Hamish. "I will go on my own."
They continued their way in grim silence. At last Charlie gave a reluctant laugh and said,
"We'll go together. May as well both get into trouble."
"Right you are," said Hamish, brightening up.
Chapter 4. In the highlands, in the country places, where the old plain men have rosy faces, and the young fair maidens quiet eyes. Robert Louis Stevenson. Because of Charlie's friendship with Colonel Halberton Smythe, they were given permission to borrow a hotel car. But the Colonel, who fancied himself a detective, wanted to come as well.
"We can't allow it, George," said Charlie soothingly. "If we're caught by the Inverness police, we'd be in double trouble for bringing a civilian along. But you could drive over to Drim and hear we chat with the locals. Maybe you might even find that missing body."
The Colonel smiled happily and said he'd go right away.
"I know you'll probably disagree with me," said Hamish, as they drove south and over the Black Isle towards Inverness. "But although Olivia Sinclair may be innocent and her story true, I feel she's up to something. I feel she's a born manipulator, and there she is, stuck out in the middle of nowhere."
"Well, everyone's innocent until they're proven guilty," said Charlie, sententiously.
As they drove into the multi-story car park, and then began to walk through the town, Hamish reflected that somehow Inverness seemed to get bigger every year. Of course, there were so many Polish immigrants that a priest had to be brought over from Warsaw. Hamish would not have been surprised to find that there was no Maggie behind the café restaurant on the Ness Bank, but some East European. But there was a Maggie, a tough-looking Glaswegian called Margaret Finlay. Her hair was dyed that colour called aubergine, and her pudgy face was crossed with little broken red veins. It was a dismal-looking place with plastic tablecloths and a grimy floor. Tattered posters advertising out-of-date events decorated the walls. Even two seagulls perched on the window ledge had dirty grey feathers. Hamish explained who they were and what they wanted to find out. Margaret led them to a table in the corner and peered at the till receipt.
"I canny remember her or him," she said, shrugging her massive shoulders and releasing a great smelly cloud of body odour mixed with a cheap perfume. "This place gets awfully busy."
Hamish looked around. Apart from one old-age pensioner gloomily eating a mutton pie, there were no other customers.
"Do you have security cameras?" asked Charlie. "What, me? Dinna be daft."
"Do you have a waitress?" asked Hamish.
"Had a girl, but she walked out."
"What was her name?"
"Alice something."
"But you'll have employment records."
"Didn't check on her. She just asked for a job, and I told her to get started, and then she just walked out before the end of the day."
Four builders came in, and Maggie hurried off to serve them.
"I should have left it to Inverness," said Hamish. "We'd better go back and put in a report. But before that, we'd better get to the entrance to Loch Drim and see if there's any evidence of smugglers."
"I hate the idea of scrambling along those mountain slopes," said Charlie. "And it's beginning to rain again."
"Archie MacLean's not doing much," said Hamish. "We'll see if he can take us round."
"Right. What about your dogs?"
"They'll be all right," said Hamish.
The fact was that, since the departure of his beloved wildcat, he shied away from any strong feelings of affection. He also felt, guiltily, that to grieve so deeply over the loss of a pet who wasn't even dead was mawkish. Colonel Halberton Smythe's enthusiasm for detection was waning fast. The police, still questioning the villagers, had told him to keep away and not interfere in police business. He dared not even go near the tower, which seemed full of white-coated forensic figures. Cold rain was being driven on a blustery wind. The old deerstalker on his head was a sopping wet lump of tweed. He decided to call at the manse as a last resort. Surely the minister wouldn't slam the door in his face. It was Sheila Haggis who answered the door to him. He introduced himself. To his relief, she was welcoming,
inviting him into a living room and taking away his wet coat and hat to the kitchen to dry them.
"So," she said, returning with a tray of mugs of coffee and a plate of biscuits, "you chose a nasty day to make a social call?"
The colonel opened his mouth to say he was detecting, but sensed he would probably get another rebuff, and said instead,
"The reason for my visit was to offer you and your brother an invitation to dinner at the Tomal Castle Hotel, which I own."
He had learned a lot from Charlie, and had suddenly remembered Charlie talking sympathetically about the Loch Doo minister, Mr. Wellington. "Folk always take their troubles to the minister," Charlie had said, "but they never wonder how he's getting on or what he thinks."
"That's very kind of you," said Sheila. "But why us?" "I suppose because nobody bothers to help ministers."
Peter Haggis walked in. His sister introduced the colonel and explained the reason for his visit.
"I say, that's so kind of you," said Peter eagerly. "A friend of mine told me the food is very good."
Sheila scowled, guessing that the friend had been Olivia Sinclair.
"What about this evening?" suggested the colonel. "Well, yes," said Peter. "It gets a bit lonely having no one of our class to talk to."
The colonel hid his shock. Hamish Macbeth, who considered the colonel to be an arch snob, would have been amused. As the colonel told Charlie later, one never expected ministers to be so uppity.
"You'll have to put us ashore somewhere,"
shouted Hamish above the noise of the fishing boat's engine.
"Can you manage it?" "It's low tide," said Archie. "See thon great flat rock at the entrance. You've got to jump for it. But you'll have to make your own way back on foot. I've got the fishing in a canopy waiting around for the next low tide."
He and Charlie managed to jump onto the flat rock, but found themselves at the foot of a tall cliff.
"Is there no way round this?" said Hamish. "We should have brought climbing equipment." "I may as well get my feet wet," grumbled Charlie. "What with the spray and the rain, I'm fair soaked."
He eased himself into the sea at the side of the great rock.
"See anything?" called Hamish. "Aye," said Charlie. "You'd better phone and get a boat here quick. There's a dead body caught under the edge of this rock."
Hamish found that he could get a signal on his phone and called for urgent help, saying the tide was rising quickly.
"We'll need to lift the body onto the rock," said Hamish. "Okay," said Charlie. "Oh, I hope bits dinna fall off. Here he comes." "Aye, I've got him. Looks like the prof."
Charlie and Hamish stood side by side on the rock, holding the dead body upright between them. Hungry waves began to dash against the rock.
"We'll be drowned if they don't hurry up," wailed Charlie.
They were almost giving up hope when a helicopter hove into view. The body had to be hoisted up first, and then, finally, they were both rescued. The dead body was to be taken straight to the morgue at Strathbane. As Hamish looked down, he shuddered as a giant wave crashed onto the rock they had been standing on. They were dropped off in the car park at police headquarters, and a waiting ambulance took the body away. Then Hamish found to his fury that Jimmy had left instructions they were to go straight to Drim. "Not until we're dried out. Let's see if we can get some transport to Loch Doo." But no police car was available. Hamish phoned for a taxi, planning to charge it on his expenses. He dropped Charlie at the hotel and said he would meet him in Drim. Hamish showered and scrubbed, feeling a smell of decomposing body sticking to him, although he felt sure it was his imagination, for what was left of the professor had taken a battering from the waves, and bits of him had been eaten by the sea creatures. He was reluctant to race back to Drim, feeling he had not had enough time to think. He made himself a bacon bap and a mug of coffee. He did not feed the dogs because Willie, the waiter at the Italian restaurant, had put a note through the door to say that both had eaten plates of ossobuco. Could any of the villagers in Drim be involved? If it was smugglers, and if it concerned drugs, then some people could easily be roped in to help because of the promises of thousands of pounds in return. He remembered the case of a Highland woman who had been caught at Gatwick Airport with 5 pounds of cocaine in her suitcase. At her trial, she had sobbed that all she had wanted was money for a new kitchen. Drugs were often brought in on some sort of large ship, which would hove to off the Outer Hebrides, A small boat would go out and unload the drugs before speeding off to the mainland. He went through to his office and phoned the Coast Guard to find out if any strange vessels had been spotted off the west coast. Nothing, he was told. Everybody accounted for. His mobile phone rang. He reluctantly answered it. It was Jimmy.
"Where are you?" "I'm in the station. Had to get out of my wet clothes. I'm just about to leave." "Well, you and Charlie have to call at your pal Handy and soothe him. Blair tried to interview him in his usual way. Handy threw him out. Then he gets on to some high-up at Police Scotland, and it's poor Daviot who gets the bollocking." "So what do you need me for?" asked Hamish. "And isn't Charlie there yet?" "Haven't seen him. But get over here, laddie. Daviot's on the warpath." "Why? Nothing to do with me."
"Listen, Blair creeps up to Daviot and whispers in his ear that isn't it strange that an ex-chief super should buy a castle in Scotland and live in the grand style? So your instructions are to look as if you're pouring oil on troubled waters, but to ferret out where he got the money." Hamish opened his mouth to say that he knew where Handy's money came from, but decided to keep that bit of information to himself. It meant a comfortable visit, and perhaps Handy knew more than he realised and wasn't aware of it. He phoned Charlie and explained why they were going to visit the castle.
"I wonder if you would mind going yourself," said Charlie. "You see, George has invited the minister and his sister to dinner, and I've been asked to join them. It might be a good way of getting some more information out of them."
"Well, that's fine," said Hamish. "Have a good meal, and ask Chef Clary for some bones for the dogs."
Hamish decided to wear off-duty clothes, because his uniform was still wet. He found a blue shirt and a striped tie, remembering with a pang that both had been presents from Priscilla. Their engagement was long over because of Priscilla's sexual coldness. But he still, in an odd way, hankered after her. A dark pair of cords and a venerable but respectable tweed jacket he had found in a charity shop completed the outfit. Lugs put a large paw on his knee, as if to remind his master that he was not looking after his dogs as he should.
"Oh, all right," said Hamish. "You can come as well. But don't blame me if he has you banished to the ruins."
As he drove through the gusty rain, he wondered about the noises that had emanated from the tower. If it had been someone playing a recording, say, and shouting, "Boo!", then no one would have been frightened. When he arrived, and found to his relief that his dogs were welcome as well, he settled down by the fire with a small whiskey and asked, "Can you describe the haunting sounds? How did they manage to frighten the village?"
"They scared me," said Handy. "It mostly sounded like the wind, and then there would be a low moan, and then a whisper that you had to strain to hear which said, 'Death, death,' and then the sounds became more like the wind. Very sophisticated, if you know what I mean."
"I gather the forensic team have not yet found any evidence of any type of recording."
"I can't help you with much," said Hamish. "I'm kept out of the picture as much as my superiors can manage. The only reason I am here is that Blair offended you and you phoned someone high up, and I am here to murmur sweet nothings in your ear."
Handy surveyed Hamish curiously. How had this lanky policeman with the flaming red hair and gentle face managed to survive so long?
"A bit of cunning and a bit of blackmail," said Hamish,
who had the odd talent of some Highlanders of reading a person's thoughts. Handy looked startled for a moment, and then assumed he had spoken his thoughts aloud.
"Have you met the glamorous Olivia?" "I wouldn't call her exactly glamorous," said Hamish. "What? That woman exudes sex and come hither, enveloping men in a force field." "No, I didn't notice. Maybe it's because I've just finished a relationship which ended in acrimony, so it's like having had a flu injection. I'm going to be immunised for a bit."
"And is your constable immune?"
"Oh, she wouldn't bother with anyone as lowly as Charlie," said Hamish.
The minister and his sister were taken aback to find that Charlie was a guest as well. Sheila Haggis, who read historical romances, assumed that Charlie was possibly an illegitimate son of the Colonel's. Peter Haggis put the big policeman down as acting as a sort of bodyguard when he was off duty. Peter said he would rather not drink alcohol, and scowled when his sister defiantly said she would like some wine. They were not handed menus. As the colonel's guests, they were expected to eat what he had ordered. It was unfortunate for them that the colonel occasionally liked to give Charlie a treat by ordering some of the policeman's favourite food. Faced with a main course of sausage and mash, Peter scowled furiously. The fact that the sausages were venison and the rich wine sauce a gourmet's delight went unnoticed. The minister regarded it as a social snub. Charlie, who had hoped to do some gentle questioning, found all his forays treated with abrupt, sharp barks of, "No," or "Don't care what a load of superstitious idiots think." And then, just as Peter was sulkily drinking coffee and trying to stop, without success, his sister ordering brandy, a voice tinkled in their ears. "Peter, darling, how sweet to meet you." The speaker leaned forward and kissed him on the cheek. The men struggled to their feet. Sheila leaned back in her chair and nursed her brandy goblet to her bosom. Olivia was wearing a blue cashmere dress which clung to her figure. Her long legs were encased in sheer black tights, ending in high-heeled strapped sandals. The minister looked as if he were lit up from within. Sheila scowled.
"Where is your husband?" she demanded.
"Oh, Selwyn is in the bar talking boring business. I saw you after I'd been to powder my nose. Much more entertaining, I thought. Please sit down. Mind if I join you?"
And without waiting for an answer, she dragged a chair from a neighbouring table, placed it next to Charlie, and sat down.
"I haven't met this gentleman before," she said.
"This is Colonel Halberton Smythe, the owner of the hotel," said Peter. "He kindly invited us to dinner." "A dinner to which you were not invited?" said Sheila.
"Oh, my dears, how rude of me!"
"No, no, lady," said the colonel. "Delighted to meet you."
"I am Olivia Sinclair. We've got a place at Tinnerty."
"Tinnerty is nowhere," said the colonel. "Doesn't a sophisticated lady like yourself find it a bit lonely?"
"No, always people around.
Do order something."
"Ate already, but thank you." She turned to Charlie. "Are you here on duty?"
"Oh, no," said Charlie, awkwardly. "I am a guest."
"How very democratic."
The little colonel bristled up. No one can be offended by snobbery more than another snob.
"Charlie is a friend of mine."
"And where is your wife? Or are you not married?"
"Visiting friends."
"She's like a calculating machine," thought Sheila. The adoration has left the copper's eyes to be replaced with speculation.
Olivia placed a hand on Charlie's arm and smiled up at him.
"You think I'm some sort of a bitch. Confess. It's just that policemen frighten me."
Before Charlie could reply, Sheila said harshly,
"The only people who are afraid of the police are people with something to hide."
"No, not true. But people like you always have such dire thoughts about people like me. Do you know why? The only exciting drama you ever had in your life was when your angel cakes failed to rise in the oven."
"I'm off to find better company," raged Sheila, throwing down her napkin and storming off. "I can only apologise for my sister," said Peter. "All this business about the dead professor has upset her."
"Don't worry," said Olivia. "Your sister's found a great excuse to go and cry on my husband's shoulder."
The minister gazed at her with adoring eyes.
"What was the professor like?" asked Charlie. "I mean, you met him."
"I told you, I thought he was just some sort of nut."
"You actually met him?" said Peter.
"Yes, my dear Haggis Pudding. I was in some sort of greasy spoon in Inverness, and he came right up to me and said I was lovely, and I told him to take a hike, and that's all there is to it."
Suddenly, Olivia set herself to please. She praised the colonel on his beautiful hotel and grounds, and she sympathised with Peter over his lonely life, and begged him to call. She found out Charlie was originally from the Outer Hebrides, and asked him many questions about the life there. At last Olivia rose and said she must rescue her husband. Charlie felt a note being pressed into his hand. After he had thanked the colonel for dinner, Charlie made his way downstairs to his flat and quickly read the note.
"Come and see me tomorrow at 10 in the morning. Don't tell anyone. Please. Olivia."
"Now what's she up to?" wondered Charlie, trying to be cynical and yet beginning to feel excited. He found Olivia dangerously attractive. To him, she looked like those models in the glossy magazines you saw in the doctor's waiting room. And there had been no real questions asked during dinner. He would phone Hamish in the morning and say he was feeling unwell. Hamish was driving back to Loch Doo after a pleasant evening. He had been invited to stay for dinner. Frieda had turned out to be amusing, but said she couldn't wait to leave Drim. On the following morning, he planned to send Charlie back to Drim while he himself would go up the west coast, searching various inlets to look for traces of smuggling. While he was in Handy's company, Hamish found himself liking and trusting the man. But once he was out of his genial orbit, doubt set in. He should check that the money had indeed come from sanitary towels. Perhaps, he thought uneasily, the very subject had been picked to deflect inquiries, for who but an honest man would choose to claim such an embarrassing source of wealth? Morning brought Charlie's phone call, saying he felt unwell and thought it might be flu. Hamish told him to stay in bed, but was not overly concerned, assuming all Charlie had was a bad cold from the drenching in the sea the day before. But the fact that he once more had the whole police station to himself delayed his departure, and he happily pottered about, repairing a leak in the hen house and checking on his small flock of sheep. He was enjoying himself so much that he began to wonder why on earth he should hanker after getting married. But maybe there was some woman out there who wouldn't mind the idea of a truly unambitious man. The rain had stopped, but it was one of those grey days in the Highlands of Scotland, when all colour seemed to have drained out of the landscape. No waves stirred on the sea loch, and a thin mist curled round the skinny boles of the forest trees on the other side. He was about to follow his dogs into the police Land Rover, when he heard himself being hailed by Mrs. Wellington, the minister's wife.
"You have brought shame on the village!" she shouted. "Shame!"
"If you don't mind, Mrs. Wellington, I'm busy."
"Oh, yes. Off to look for another poor lady to seduce and cast off."
Hamish sighed. The minister's wife had been joined by the Curry sisters, their glasses almost steamed up with curiosity.
"Ladies, I was the one who was cast off," said Hamish piously.
He took a large handkerchief out of his pocket and blew his nose.
"Excuse me, I canna talk about it."
He jumped into the driver's seat and drove off, leaving the three women staring after him with baffled looks on their faces, like three foxes balked of their prey. Hamish suddenly slammed on the brakes on the other side of the humpback bridge that led out of the village. Charlie! What was he up to? Charlie was never ill, nor was he lazy. But he had got into woman trouble before, and he had been smitten by Olivia. Hamish set off again and drove into the car park of the hotel. He was waylaid by the manager, Mr. Johnson.
"If you're looking for young Carter, he's gone off somewhere. Was a woman called Olivia Sinclair here last evening?"
"Selwyn's missus. Yes, she joined the Haggises and Charlie for dinner."
"Thanks."
Hamish drove steadily in the direction of the Sinclair home. He wondered just what Olivia was up to. Certainly women found Charlie attractive, with his fair hair, blue eyes, and gentle manners. Maybe she had something to hide. If she got Charlie in her coils, she could find out how far the case was progressing. Rain began to fall heavily, and a thick mist rolled down from the mountains. He slowed to a crawl, the windscreen wipers performing their metronome strokes almost hypnotic. And then columns of mist began to weave and writhe in front of him as a little breeze arose. And, just as suddenly as it had descended, the mist rolled up the mountains, the rain stopped, and a glimmer of sunlight shone on the drenched countryside. There, in the distance, appeared the Sinclair's home, and he could see Charlie's battered old car outside.
"Come upstairs,"
Olivia was saying to Charlie. "There's something I would like you to see." Charlie cocked his big head to one side.
"I hear a car coming," he said. "Are you expecting your husband home?"
Olivia quickly fastened the top two buttons of her blouse, which she had earlier undone to show some cleavage. She jerked open the door and looked up at Hamish Macbeth.
"What do you want, officer?" she demanded.
Hamish smiled. He was tempted to say, "Please may I have my constable back," like a small boy asking for a stray ball that had landed in a neighbour's garden.
"I need to speak to Constable Carter," he said.
Charlie loomed up behind her.
"What are you doing here?" he asked. "We're looking for you. More to the point, what are you doing here?" "Oh, I just suddenly thought of something important," said Charlie.
"Here it comes," thought Hamish, knowing that every Highlander has the talent of lying in his DNA. But Charlie surprised him.
"I was just working up to asking Mrs. Sinclair what a lady like herself was doing in a dump like Maggie's when Inverness is full of smart places to have coffee." "And?" "I haven't asked her yet." "And what is your reply, Mrs. Sinclair?" asked Hamish.
"My reply is, bugger off the pair of you and mind your own business, or..."